You're listening to the Round Table Podcast, episode 15.
Hi everyone, I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and pitch their story ideas to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we bite into it and talk about what works, what doesn't work, kick around some ideas, try to fine-tune it until we can come up with some kind of a solid, writable story that Dave likes to call...
literary gold.
That's right.
We bite into it? Is that what we do?
Well, yeah, I didn't want to say dig, so I thought, you know, I'm kind of always into the villain, and they have teeth, right?
Your villains do, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
How's life on your end of the rainbow, Bri?
Oh, man. It's crazy. It's the...
You're getting ready to wrap up school, right?
Yeah. We're pretty close to the end. And so we got things like graduation rehearsal and, you know, all this craziness and all these seniors who are failing that I got to go hold their hands through the last week and a half. And it gets pretty ridiculous.
Now, you have stellar students too, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I don't mean to always, you know, make it sound like my students are, you know... the bottom of the barrel. I have some pretty fabulous, fantastic students.
You teach creative writing, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So do you have anybody in there who you think you'll have on the show in a few years in the future?
That's a definite possibility. If no one else, I have Nathan Lowell's daughter in one of my classes.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty fabulous. But yeah, no, I definitely have some shining stars. And in fact, a couple of them, they're doing this final project right now where they have to do everything that we learned in the semester and all into a culminating script project that they then have to go out and steal cameras and film. And
you're advocating theft and larceny.
Well, I do tell them, I say, you know, when I graduated from college, we had Nicolas Cage was our guest speaker, which was really cool. Mm. And so he advocated begging, borrowing, and stealing in order to get done whatever you need to get done. And so I tell them the same thing, but then I tell them that if they ever get caught, they're not allowed to say that I said to do that because I would lose my job. But they're really phenomenal, and I'm really looking forward to that last day when we get to watch all the films and sit back and eat donuts.
Fabulous.
Yep.
Fabulous. Well, you know, along the lines of sitting back and eating donuts, and that's probably the worst segue I've ever tried to pull out of my butt.
we'll take it.
Thank you. Let's introduce our guest host for this episode of the Roundtable Podcast. Folks, you all know him. He's the author of Shadow Ops Control Point. Three tours in Iraq, came back and threw down an awesome urban fantasy tale, a military fantasy tale, blazing some new trails and breaking some new ground in that genre. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Skype line, Mr. Mike Cole. Mike, welcome back, man.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Mike, please, for us and for our audience, what are you working on now? Control Point is out. I know that you've done a lot of interviews. What does our audience need to know is coming down the pipe in Mike Cole's world?
Okay, well, the sequel to Control Point Fortress Frontier is done and handed in. That'll be out in 9 months. Should be hitting shelves in January 2013 from Ace. I'm currently writing the third book in the series, Breach Zone, which will be out January 31st of 2014. And I have an essay on post-traumatic stress disorder and how it impacts, get this, the characters in George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, wow.
Which is in a book of essays called Beyond the Wall, which is coming out from Smart Pop Books. I think it hits shelves on June 26th. And the next thing in the pipe after all of this is I've got a new series idea and possibly some additional Shadow Ops books that I'll be pitching to my publisher through my agent. So fingers crossed that they go for that.
Sweet.
Definitely.
Sweet. And Mike, I must commend you. When I first, you know, I first encountered you actually on Twitter because everybody was talking about Mike Cole. Everybody was throwing out, you know, Shadow Ops, awesome book. And as it turns out, I read it and they're right. And that was my primary focus and awareness of your skills as an author. But in researching you in consideration for the show, I discovered, holy crap, you have not only written multiple short stories, but nonfiction work and a great deal of commentary on speculative fiction and genre fiction in general. Where does that come from?
I think like any nerd, you grow up in the literature, and when you grow up in the literature, you grow up thinking about it, and you grow up talking about it. I mean, look, I said this the last time I was on the show with you, is that I am a dyed-in-the-wool, old school D&D comic book science fiction and fantasy nerd. It's been my whole life from jump, and there is nothing I like more. And if you ever catch up with me at a con, you'll find this out, than to sit around and dissect, the latest book or the latest movie and talk about Darth Vader's motivations outside the dealer's room for 4 hours. I mean, I love that stuff. And I think I also, I kind of grew up admiring China Mayville in science fiction and fantasy. As you know, he is both an academic.
Oh, very much so.
And as well as a speculative fiction writer. And I would never, ever compare myself to China Mayville, but I definitely took a page from that book and wrote a lot of commentary and nonfiction in the field.
Well, you can go to any blog, and yes, you're absolutely right. Nerds and geeks have opinions out the wazoo, a metric butt ton of opinions based on the comments and so on. But you've taken it really to the next level. I mean, the observations and insights that you bring to bear on the topics that you address are relevant and insightful and open new windows of awareness and experience. And I'm just wondering, you've obviously written other nonfiction work. Was there an early urge towards the desire to speak and articulate in writing?
Oh yeah, I mean, I never thought I would be a novelist. I mean, I initially. God, I've had so many career shifts in my life. It's ridiculous. You know, my friend Pete, the author Peter Brett, is always accusing me. He says, dude, if you die tomorrow, you'll have had more careers than most people will have in their whole lifetime, and you're not even 40 yet. and it's kind of sad but true. One of my early goals in life was to be an academic or to be a journalist. You know, I worked in the federal government for many years and wrote a lot about military theory and thought that was going to be, I was sort of modeling myself at that time off of a famous military intellectual, a retired Marine Corps colonel named Thomas Hammes, who wrote a book called The Sling and the Stone. And you'll see on the nonfiction section of my bibliography that for a while I was publishing pretty steadily articles about counterterrorism and intelligence applications and fifth-generation warfare theory and that kind of stuff. My heart was always in science fiction and fantasy, though, and it was always what I wanted to do. And, I'll be honest, I just never thought I would be able to do it. And now that I can, or at least now that I am, I'm in no hurry to be writing a lot of other nonfiction articles. But let's see, if the book contract completes and I'm unable to land another one, all of a sudden you might see a lot more nonfiction credits showing up in my bibliography again.
Well, I won't blow sunshine up your butt, but I don't think you're going to have a problem with that. I think I think you're definitely on track with where you're going. Because like I said, you're blazing trails in terms of military fantasy to the degree that you're taking it. And God, it reads, it's a page turner.
Thanks, so, man. I need to keep you around when I have anxiety attacks.
That's right. I'm just one Skype call away, babe.
That's
3
right.
3 o'clock in the morning. Dave! I'm here for you, brother.
Right.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we pause here? Mike will definitely make sure that all of that awesome goodness ends up in the liner notes. And friends, do check out Mike's bibliography on his website, mikecole.com.
M-Y-K-E-C-O-L-E.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, good point. M-Y-K-E-C-O-L-E.com. It's an intriguing read, and it'll take you places you haven't been before. And that's the most anyone can ever ask of a fantasy author. So do that, but not right now. Stay right where you are, because we're going to pause for a promotional break. When we come back, we'll workshop some story action and see if we can't dig up some literary gold. Sound good, gents?
Let's get into it.
Awesome. Folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Gatian Genetics, serving the mad scientist community for over 30 years, is prepared to give listeners of Supervillain Corner the deal of a lifetime. Finding that your hand just isn't living up to its potential? maybe a claw or tentacle will be more to your liking. Simply visit one of our 42 locations, mention that you're a fan of the show, and we'll supply you with one free limb replacement or 25% off total gene resequencing. Remember, we only hire the best, brightest, and most insane mad scientists, and our procedures are insured for up to 90 days. We are committed to remaking your body and the bodies of your minions the way they were meant to be. Gatian Genetics. When human just isn't enough.
Hear this and more at Supervillain Corner. Supervillaincorner.podbean.com.
And we're back. Thanks for sticking around for the meat and potatoes of the Roundtable Podcast. This is what we're all about, sitting down and working through story ideas. We need a guest writer to do that. And tonight, we have good master John Walker joining us. John is not only a writer and a geek, power to the geeks, but he's also got a book already out there, The Sincerest Form of Flattery, the first in the Tom Statford series, available in ebook on Amazon.com. John, thank you so much, man, for stepping up and offering up a story for the Roundtable.
My pleasure, Dave. I was, you know, I'll admit I'm still kind of nervous about the service, but hey, you know.
Well, no worries. It's just a bunch of guys sitting around a table talking about story ideas. So tell us about yourself. Where you're at? What do you do? And how did you get into writing?
I've been writing for about, for myself, you know, not as a profession, probably since I was like in fifth, sixth grade.
You caught the bug early.
Yeah, it's just stupid stories, you know. I had, you know, growing up, I had the zombie thing, and I had the supernatural thing, and then the gun foo thing. So
gun foo.
Yeah, dude. Come on, everybody loves gun foo, you know.
You're talking like the gun caught out of Equilibrium. That thing.
That is one of my favorite Christian Bale movies ever.
It's pretty awesome.
Great movie. It's an absolutely great movie and totally underappreciated.
It is. I've actually got it on DVD right next to me, so it's one of my favorites. But then I got bitten very badly by the science fiction bug. Took about three years to write a novel. It was kind of ended up almost being the new Battlestar Galactica. And I was like, oh, Christ. Now, and then I started working for a living, and then I said, you know what? Let me write a detective novel. I love Jim Butcher. Let's see how bad I can make it suck.
And that's exactly the opposite of the case, isn't it? You're getting some good feedback on Sincerest Form, right?
I know. It's like, I'm like, holy crap. You guys think I can write?
Well, let's find out. Let's get into that. You got a story for us, right?
I certainly do. It's actually book two. Taking up like 15 nanoseconds after Sincerest Form left off. I even ended it like that, you know.
Awesome. Then let's get into that. Tell us about the story idea. You got 5 to 8 minutes, uninterrupted. The mic is completely yours. Give us the basic characters, protagonists, antagonists, basic plot structure. Give us whatever you got. And when it's done, we'll start kicking around some ideas.
All right, I will be happy to do so, sir. Okay, title of course is In the Details. But it's book two of the Stafford Chronicles. It explores the question of who defends the devil when he's innocent, when he's been wrongly accused of something. Yeah, I know. You've got the main characters. You've got Tom Stafford. He's a private detective. He's been doing it for years, but he's also what's known as the keeper. He's the last and only line of defense between all the gods ever of all time, from the African pantheon all the way up to the relatively younger Jehovah. He's the one who's got to defend, in this case, the devil. You know, he's the devil's advocate at this point. But then you got, he's got a kind of a sidekick named Larry. That's his nickname. He's a 6,000-year-old ghost who has lived through civilization after civilization, and he knows stuff. He knows people. He knows deities. He's the ghost in the know, basically. And then, of course, you've got the devil. I'm trying my best not to make him damn likable, but, you know. From there, you've got the minor characters. You've got, you've got Tom's girlfriend, who's a cop, who regularly beats the crap out of him on occasion. You got his other cop friend, Jim McPherson, who keeps him in, like, a job. The plot goes real... I mean, I keep it kind of almost real time. The main point is the devil's being hunted by the forces of heaven for something he doesn't know what the hell happened. He's like, oh, wait, why is my back being turned into hamburger? And so he escapes, says, hey, Keeper, help me out here. Keeper's like, why? Devil's like, okay, you want Armageddon to happen? Be my guest. You know, go ahead and let me die. I don't care. So Tom, of course, says, well, okay. Come to find out that there's a priest who got killed, and the killer said that the devil made him do it. And for some reason, this priest is well-loved by the forces of heaven, and they're kind of pissed, and they're coming after Nick, or the devil, you know. And Tom has to prove his innocence at this point. And once things just stop adding up, and Tom goes off to rattle some cages. And it's really going to be. I'm really enjoying writing it at this time. I'm just kind of looking for those nice little hooks. So
we're going to need a little bit more than that to hook into. But what happens after the dead priest?
Well, that's when what happens after the dead priest. The killer is already in police custody and ends up killing himself in jail. Stuff like that just doesn't add up when they find out that the kid who killed him was like just completely and totally. I mean, we're talking goody two shoes. Never been in trouble a day in his life. Never, you know. It's kind of tough to explain without giving away too much of the plot. You know, because it is kind of a mystery, kind of a murder mystery. I don't want to go too, I guess I don't want to go too far with it.
Well, but what can we do if you don't go too far with it?
Well, buy me dinner first. No, okay.
Give us something to hang our hats on as far as plot goes.
All right, as far as
some key points, just key points real quick. We got a couple minutes yet.
Okay, those are, all right, key points. Tom has to stop this. The devil, if the devil dies, that's it. Game over. Armageddon. We're all done. Someone is trying to frame the devil for a crime he didn't commit, which is the death of this, or inspiring the death of this priest. Now, the kicker I'm putting in here is there's a mastermind behind all this who wants to be the father of the Messiah. Okay?
Okay.
Now, the father of the Messiah ends up being this priest.
Who died?
So the one who got killed.
Okay.
Who's going to be the father of the Messiah. But the bottom line is, you kill the original's father, you become the father of the Messiah. So it's a basic, blatant power grab. And, you know, and that's kind of the hook there. That's kind of the reason why the archangels are trying to end the existence of the devil.
Okay. All right. it's a good starting point. I'm sure there'll be a few more questions.
Yes,
and
I do better with questions than I do with, you know.
I think we can definitely start there.
We can hook in there. All right. Let's lead in. Brian, why don't you lead off with our patent disclaimer, if you would.
Absolutely. Okay, so in the course of everything that we offer here, between Dave, myself, and Mike, anything and very likely everything that we have to say can and possibly is complete and total bullshit. So take everything that we say with a not just a grain of salt, but a very big shovel.
A huge chunk of salt. Yes. Absolutely.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. That said, let's go ahead and roll into this. And we always defer to our guest host, Mike Cole. First impressions, questions, points of clarification, anything that struck you as John was laying out his story. Kick us off on this one.
All right, John, it doesn't help me to sit here and tell you what's good, right? I mean, you need pointers to sort of help pull forward. So let me start off by setting a groundwork of you clearly have very creative and a good font of ideas that are original and neat here. So like please, as we move forward, proceed with that baseline in mind. You know, you clearly have something cool and original here. There are some points of derivation I'm seeing that you'll want to be aware of. And you have to remember that in fantasy and science fiction, everything's derivative because everything's been done, right? So I just tell you these things so that you can be aware of them. So as you move forward, you can be aware of what's come before and what you might be pushing close to. You obviously know Jim Butcher and Harry Dresden, so please keep that in mind. Make sure that you're keeping track with what Jim Butcher's doing as you move along along this path. You also want to be on top of Neil Gaiman's Good Omens and Donasazi Boys and
American Gods.
Yeah, and Greg Van Eekhout's Norse Code. All those books that blend the mythological pantheon into real life. No, I'm not saying that you are repeating that. I'm just saying that you probably want to be aware of it to make sure that your spin on the gods meets real life thing is different. Am I making myself clear?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't want to. Everything's been done. I don't want you to think that, like, oh my God, this is serious. So, but just, you know, I would be reading those things and being aware of those things. There is also a little bit, if you can believe it or not, of Philip Pullman in here. I don't know if you've read his famous trilogy, his Dark Materials, but it concludes in The Subtle Knife with the killing of God. I think that's some stuff you might want to poke into and make sure that you're looking at as you move forward to make sure that you're, you know what's been done and you know how to spin differently from it. The first questions I have are pretty basic ones here. Yes, the first is, so the death of the devil brings about Armageddon. We're accepting that as you know, a patent truth. Why would heaven want that? Why not imprison the devil? Why not? I mean, clearly, I guess that your argument is going to be, well, they killed the father of the Messiah. But why would a heaven that's based on forgiveness and sufferance and tolerance and all things good vengefully seek to take the devil's life if they knew it would bring about the end of the world?
Good question.
I know. Damn it. I was starting to feel good about myself. No.
Oh, come on. Enough of that.
I'm joking. No. The mythology that I'm going with is the gods are just people, are almost like people. I did read American Gods. I loved it. I love Neil Gaiman. The guy is absolutely freaking brilliant.
We can all agree with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And by the way, looks exactly like my brother. It's the weirdest thing in the world.
It's creepy, dude. That's almost creepy. Like, Neil, oh, hey, bro, how's it going? But with the mythology, the mythology I'm setting up, the gods have almost a daily interaction with us puny mortals, just because we fascinate them so, because their power structure, their power derives from our belief in them, and even they don't have as many believers as they used to, they're still around. So they're kind of a permanent thing. So, but they're also possessed of a people's desire. And it's mostly, I'm kind of leaving the big guy out of it. It's mostly his, you know, his angels who are kind of really upset about this. And it's going to come out a little bit And I'm thinking it's, and this is something I'm adding in. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. is that they were supposed to protect him, protect this priest, and they dropped the ball. Not only
So they're covering up their blunder.
In a sense, yes.
So your representation of Christian angels in this case, they feel more to me from what you've just described, like the ancient Greek perception of the gods.
Yes.
Sort of having very human failings.
Yes, kind of going back to the first book. The first book, the gods have they appear. The Greek gods appear and are also very human. So, yeah, they're like people. So yeah, it's.
So you're kind of rocking like a supernatural vibe, like the TV show.
Kind of, but Tom does not look anything like the Winchester.
No, I mean, I'm thinking mythology and the way that the angels in particular behave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. But they still look better than he does. So,
so these angels, to follow up on Mike's question, these angels are willing to destroy creation and bring about Armageddon to cover their ass?
Not just to cover their ass, but in vengeance for the death of, the death of this, of the father of the Messiah.
Okay.
Now, that does bring in to what I was saying before about the guy behind all this crap, why he's doing this. He is trying to become him, if that makes any sense.
Become he's trying the devil?
No, become the, no, the father, father of the Messiah.
Become the father of the Messiah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm just introducing that to where it's like he's, it's like I said, it's a blatant power grab. You know, you're father of Messiah. If you're the father of Messiah, you kind of control it.
Okay.
Him or her.
That's good motivation. Okay.
Yeah, and it's going to be a very interesting. It's a very interesting trip that I'm going to get there. And again, Mike, thanks.
Well, hey, got to ask those questions, man.
So I'm not going to let you off the hook that easy.
I
got all that, but I think here's what I think's going on here.
Sir.
I think you've got Armageddon here because you want high stakes. You want the fate of the universe to hang in the balance so that your readers are going to be like, oh shit, this matters, right?
Right.
And you're right, and that is a good instinct, and you're right on with that. But what I don't think, it's not convincing me is the motivation, the vengeance motivation, the pettiness of the angels, and I'm just sort of like racking my own brain to find a way to make that work. And some things that are coming off the top of my skull here, and this is that maybe they're not going to kill the devil, they're going to do something else, like imprison him or banish him, and whatever that thing they're going to do is unwittingly cause Armageddon, or maybe their action, the devil has some kind of, suicide belt, that he could set off that would cause Armageddon if the angels don't know about it. And those are just things I'm pulling off the top of my head. The point being is that the motivation for the angels to act has got to be more realistic to plug your reader in. And the thing, again, is that unless, of course, the angels don't really care about creation, but from what you've set up, it just sounds to me like these angels exist in a context with humanity. The existence of the universe matters to them, and they don't want to see it destroyed. And it should also matter to the devil. So the reason that Armageddon's going to happen, I'd want, and honestly, I don't have the answer right off the top of my head, but those are just some like ideas. I think, and I don't even think it's a lot of heavy lift to shift that a little bit. To make it hold a little more water. Am I making sense? Does that sound right?
Oh, it does. I mean, I'm only about halfway. I'd say about half, two thirds away through writing it.
Are you writing prose straight off, or are you outlining first?
Both, really. I mean, I have an outline.
John, this is not for everybody. But George R. R. Martin, he has that great speech where he says that writers are architects or gardeners, and I've heard the term plotters and pantsers. I am an uber plotter, which is an uber architect. Before I write a word of prose, I write about at least a 50 to 100 page outline, which lays out everything that's going to happen in my book chapter by chapter. And the reason that that's really useful for me is that those kinds of questions, because you get close to your work and you don't see, because you're excited about it and you're caught up in telling the story, things that can come back to bite you on the ass. Like we have in just a very short time, and again, I don't think it's a heavy lift. I think this is very easily overcome. One plot issue here. Having that intensive outline process and having that outline beta read and critiqued before you write a word of prose can sometimes catch these things in advance. And I'll give you an example. I wrote this. I wrote the outline for Breach Zone before I started writing the prose, and brought it into my agent, and I had him read it and critique it, and he had me throw out the entire second section of the book before I started writing a word of prose. And compare that to Fortress Frontier, where I had already finished the book, and he was like, "Nope, you got to throw out," and it was something like 30,000 words. John, it's different for everybody, and you may find that that does not work for you. But as we have this conversation, I want to throw that out there as a suggestion that a really solid bulleted outline where you break out everything that happens in the book might give you an analytical tool to sort of look at these, like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and attack these problems item by item.
Especially in the context of a mystery, a murder mystery or a mystery of any kind, knowing the clues, knowing the arc, knowing the episode. We had a great recording with P.G. Holyfield, who wrote Murder at Avedon Hill, which was a murder mystery. And having all of at least the clues and the motivations and the key events in place was a huge help.
Huge help. I want to ask my next question. And this is another sort of like outline plot point question. Sure. So our main antagonist, who's bringing about Armageddon, is seeking to supplant the father of the Messiah by killing him,
right,
and therefore becoming the father of the Messiah.
Right.
Two questions about that. One, how is that even possible? If you kill a dude, you don't have the same kid that he would have. And then two, if this brings about Armageddon, what the hell's the point?
Let me answer that in reverse order. The guy behind it all, well, power grabs like this. Killing someone is not a rational act. Okay, you and I both know this, Mike. Ending another person.
Does that imply that Brian and I don't? Come on now.
Yeah. Totally leaving us out. I appreciate it.
Honestly, Brian and I are clearly psychopathic killers. Carry on, John. Right. Got it. Okay.
I thought it went without saying with you guys.
I'm sorry. Carry on.
No, but as you guys know, killing someone, a murder is not a rational act. Killing someone in self-defense, is still not a rational act. But killing someone merely just for the power that you might get is the epitome of irrational. You don't really give a shit if you get, if it lasts a minute, a day, a year, or whatever. You're out of your freaking mind at that point. So.
Yeah, I'm going to throw a flag that, John. I don't buy it.
Flag down?
I think that the best antagonists are, and let me give you a great example of this. I love Magneto, and anyone who's, and you said you read Control Point, you can clearly see that Scylla's character is largely ripped off of his. I steal very liberally in my writing. But the that's exactly right. But the thing that makes antagonists compelling and believable and gripping is when they make sense, when in their own mind, they're the good guy. And right. And when your argument is my antagonist is an irrational, crazy, evil person, then the reader's like, well, whatever. I mean, yeah, I guess they're scary, but they don't identify so much. Now, Magneto in the X-Men is making a very compelling argument. He's saying that we, the mutants, are stronger than humanity, and yet we are oppressed by humanity, and that's not right. And therefore, you call me evil and you call me a criminal, but what am I really doing? I'm really fighting for the rights of an oppressed race. We are the next rung on the evolutionary ladder. Humanity has not accepted that, and I am here to to defend other mutants and usher in a new order where we take our rightful place at the head of humanity. And you know what? As a human who's not mutant, I don't like that, but man, that argument makes a hell of a lot of sense. Let me give you another example.
Okay.
And this is an aside. Have you guys read A Song of Ice and Fire, George R. R. Martin's books?
Yep.
John?
No, I have not. I have failed. I have disgraced my family.
You haven't failed. All right, well, I'm gonna ruin them for you to make a point. You can curse my name later. Is that you'll learn in the beginning of the book, Jamie Lannister, who's one of the major antagonists, pushes this kid out a window. And you'll see this in the TV series, too, to protect the fact that he's having sex with his sister. He wants to keep that a secret. And you think, my God, man, this guy really stinks. And you have no love for him at all. And by the end of the sixth book of that series, you are rooting for Jamie Lannister. And you identify with him, and you understand him, and you really get why he is in love with his sister, and why it's okay for him to have sex with her. And it is the most amazing experience as a reader. Because let me tell you, making you root for a child-murdering, incestuous person is a real skill. But the point is that Martin's real gift shines by making that antagonist make sense and identify with the reader. And that's your challenge here, I think, with this same wannabe Messiah character.
Right, yeah. And here's the thing. I was actually going to make that point.
Oh, okay.
It makes sense in the dude's mind. In his mind, this is the way it was supposed to be. He's not killing, I mean, having the priest killed, that was a minor trifle. All he was having done is, and that's English, I think, all he was having done was restoring what in his mind was the natural order. He is the one who should, you know, pound out the Messiah. In his mind, he is, you know, like, justified. Not only is he justified, he's like kind of angry that you know, God didn't.
Well, but like Mike was saying, how is that possible? So you kill the guy who was gonna father the Messiah. How does this guy step in and take over that role?
Well, that's because the line is matrilineal, maternal, something like that. Help me out. It's on the mother's side.
Yeah, yeah.
So the gene.
So these guys are related.
No. So, like, the mother is destined to have the Messiah. It doesn't really matter who the man is.
Exactly.
Okay, so there's a woman who is slated somewhere in this story to birth the Messiah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, we meet her eventually?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. And it does come into a... There's a showdown, and...
So he bumps off her husband, and then he... Does he force himself on her? What happened?
He is going to force himself on her, unless Tom can stop this.
Does this priest not have any kind of chastity requirement?
He's not a Catholic priest.
There's the thing. Therein lies the rub.
Ooh, sexy.
Eastern Orthodox Church. Priests can marry as long as they are married prior to, as long as before they take their vows.
Right, right. Okay. That makes sense.
All right. So Mike's raised some excellent points that are still up on the shelf. I want to bring Brian into the discussion. Brian, please, what do you got for Master John?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, okay. Here we go.
All right. I have several things, so I'll try to get through them very quickly.
Sir.
One is, you mentioned right at the beginning that you're afraid of making the devil likable, and I think he absolutely needs to be. I think he needs to not only be likable, but he needs to be charming, and pardon the pun, but devilishly so.
Mm.
Did you just go there? Holy crap.
I'm sorry. It's one of those nights.
Oh, Brian, that was a hell of a pun.
I would say take him to the furthest extent that you can and make him absolutely the most likable character in the entire thing, just on the basis that one of the most sadistic things about the devil is that it's like in The Usual Suspects when he says that the greatest trick that the devil ever pulled was convincing us that he didn't exist.
Yep.
And I think it's very similar, is that if he is the most likable character in the story, then he's has not only done his job on the readers, or not only done his job on the characters within the book, but on the readers as well. So that was just kind of my two cents as far as that went. Let me see. Okay, so getting into the whole like angels getting involved and stuff, and it sounds like you've brought in some Greek mythology, and I definitely need to read the first one. There's a really cool thing. One of my favorite things about Norwegian mythology is that when they bring about Ragnarok, when the end of the world comes, they already know that they're going to lose. They know that Loki and the evil side is going to win, and the whole point of it is that the old guard, the, you know, Odin and Thor and all of the gods that are trying to fight on the side of good, have kind of passed their usefulness, and so when they are defeated, a new good will have an opportunity to rise. And so what if you have one of the angels who maybe was kind of wishy-washy in the original battle between good and evil, or heaven and hell, who is bound and determined to bring about the end of the world, to give the opportunity for a new good to rise, very sort of misguided as it may be. And then that would kind of open up the, you know, why would the angels want this to happen if it would bring about Armageddon? So that's just a possibility. That's just a what if to throw out there. And then the only other thing that I had, well, not the only other thing, but one of the other major things that I had, had to do with, and I have to find it here really fast. It's really hard for me to take the death of a priest as being this catalyst for heaven wanting to hunt down the devil. 'Cause I'm thinking that his list of, bad things that he has been involved in far, far outweigh the death of one priest, regardless of whether or not the priest was meant to be the father of the Messiah.
Plus, so this can't be the first killer. This can't be the first killer who said, the devil made me do
right,
it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm having trouble struggling with. And so, I don't know, can you expand on that a little bit?
Okay. The thing is, usually, you know, saying the devil made me do it is like one of the biggest cop-outs ever. But in this case, it's, you know, you have someone who's beloved by heaven, in this case, this priest, who is also under the protection. Like I said, they dropped the ball, got kicked under the fridge. So they fracked up. They mm-hmm. really fracked up. So, again, it's kind of covering covering their asses, and some good old fashioned Sodom and Gomorrah rain the hell down vengeance.
So the angels are pointing the finger, they're trumping up the charges, they're making the accusations. There is no evidence that points to the devil,
right? Except by the word of a young man who never done anything wrong in his life, all of a sudden, you know, popping 3 in the 10 ring on this guy. So
the angels can't read his mind. They don't have the power to determine the truth in your universe.
No, and that's kind of a shortcoming. I get it, but there's some things there are some things that, in my opinion, you make, you know, it's like, oh, the angels show up, and it's like when Superman shows up. Oh, Superman shows up, everything's cool now. Oh, the angels show up, everything's cool now. I want them to have some failings. Is everybody in this whole universe is an imperfect creature, even the gods. So I don't want a case
the angels have weaknesses. The angels can't read minds. They're flawed beings.
Right.
Okay. And Mike, were you going somewhere with that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess I don't understand how killing the devil covers up for their screw up.
Right.
This guy says the devil made me do it. All right, well, I guess we'll go kill the devil. I mean, like, these are angels for crying out loud. Even humans would be like, well, just because he says the devil made him do it doesn't mean the devil really made him do it. Let's interrogate this guy and find out the truth. Now, and right. then if the guy kills himself in custody, like you said, so they can't even do that, mm-hmm. well, don't you think they do a little detective work first and try to figure out, like, I mean, it's going to cause Armageddon for Christ's
sake. Well, that's also where Tom comes in. Because remember, Tom's a detective, and Tom has worked with these guys.
Right.
So wait, but it wasn't the angel, it wasn't the devil hiring Tom, or the angels have hired Tom?
The devil hired Tom because he got to him first.
It's all dibs.
You know, it's all about dibs.
Go ahead, there's a short story called "The Devil and Tom Walker," and in the story, when Tom Walker makes a deal with the devil puts a black thumbprint on his forehead. And I almost want there to be something like that with this kid, where there's some devil's mark or some, you know, something that shows a pact has been made that the devil didn't do. Then leads them to believe that the devil was involved.
That's proof
when he really wasn't.
Proof to the hero that the devil's innocent, at least in this case.
Right. Or... Yeah. You know, shows that the angels see and go, that is the devil's mark. Only the devil can make that mark. So he must have had a pact with him. But there's something that Tom sees that's different.
So, and let me just be clear and make sure that we got the motivations down here. John, what you're saying is that the devil really didn't do this.
Right.
And that because this guy who wants to be the father of the Messiah was able to get under the angel's radar and kill the designated father of the Messiah, they have decided to blame Satan for their screw up. They're talking to their higher ups and saying, it's the devil. He did it. And they're manufacturing evidence or whatever, just in a petty attempt to avoid punishment for allowing this to happen. So that's the situation, right?
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. I'm going to let you write up my capsule stuff from now on, Dave.
Okay.
Thanks.
So they don't believe, the angels don't believe that the devil did it.
They know the devil didn't do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes. And
let me ask a couple of questions.
Oh, please do.
Okay.
Please do, Dave.
Dude, three sentences or less. Okay.
Can they be compound sentences?
No.
That's pretty harsh, Dave.
Dude, John Walker's a rambling man. We need to box him in a little bit. Three sentences or less.
Three sentences.
What is the purpose of the Keeper, and why does it exist in the first place?
The Keeper is the first, last, and only line of defense between the gods and mortals.
Why do the gods need defense against the mortals? Why do they need a Keeper?
No, the mortals need defense against the gods.
Ah, okay. How did Tom become designated the Keeper?
Blind luck.
Seriously?
Oh, boo!
Boo! Unacceptable.
Yeah, fix that.
That's a pivotal point. I mean, this is your protagonist, man. Accidents and happenstance. That's as bad as Deus Ex Machina. You can't do that.
The Ninja Turtles were an accident, Dave, and they're awesome. Yeah.
Thank you.
John.
It's not blind luck. It's not blind luck. I just was tweaking you.
Oh, dude.
It is an entire part of this whole series why Tom Stafford was chosen as the Keeper. There is a complete and total reason why.
And you're not going to tell us.
I can't.
Oh. All right. Here's my riff. All right, here's my thing. You're holding out on us.
That's like telling you the end of the Dark Tower series, man.
All right, let me ask you this. Go ahead. What, Mike?
I gave up on that after Stephen King wrote himself into the story. That's where I got off the bus. You kidding me?
The hubris.
Oh, God.
It could have been worse.
All right, so I'm willing to accept, John, that you're gonna hold back the details that will allow us to workshop this particular story.
That's the only detail.
Yeah, and others. That's cool. We can work with this. Let me ask you this. This is your second book in what I expect is going to be a long series, right?
About seven. I'm looking at seven.
Okay. All right. Why in the first book, you've established that all of the pantheons in the world are out there, and the first book focuses largely on the Greek.
Yes.
Why, for your second book, are you going for the biggest, baddest, hugest, there is nothing above it pantheon of them all? I would think you would hold that in check until the end for the big climactic finish.
Because this is not the biggest one. There is actually a plan.
Okay. Okay.
All of these characters, including the devil, including Michael, including Mac, they all interconnect. They all have...
Do you have this mapped out?
I have this mapped out to the end.
Okay. All right.
And I will be happy to take criticism on every step of the way. I freaking love you guys.
Was not intended as a criticism. It was just in seeing the...
Constructive criticism.
And seeing the scope as it was, it struck me as peaking a little early in the sequence. But if you've got a plan, I can get behind that.
Hey, man, hats off to you, because I had when I wrote the Shadow Op series, book one was written. Book two, I had sort of written. Book three was a couple of paragraphs. That's now an outline. And as I come up with pitches for other ideas in the Shadow Op series, I kind of don't know where I'm going until I get there. So hats off to you for having 7 books.
No kidding.
I wish I had 7 books planned.
All right. Let me put this out there.
Sure.
Picking up on what Brian was laying down about the devil.
Yep.
Just in looking at your cast of characters as you've laid them out for us, the devil is probably the most interesting of the lot.
Yes, he is.
Okay. Is he featured prominently in your story?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Oh, shit, yes.
Okay. I don't know what your end game is, but the notion of the devil coming to a mortal for help, in spite of the backstory and the world building that you've done, which sounds awesome, by the way. I love the idea of an interceding mortal that stands between the gods and the gods' wrath on humanity. That's awesome. That's the stuff of heroes. And the fact that he's a scruffy detective, so much the better. But the devil is... If the devil is not behind this whole thing, I think you're missing a golden opportunity. I can see the devil whispering in the ear, not even directly, but somehow this whole machination, this whole plot has been a ploy on the part of the devil to get that middle tier of angels thrown out. Armageddon was never on the table. The devil had no intention of letting that happen. That's screw that. The devil has games within games within games. But if this whole thing was a plot to lure out those rash angels and bring them into the heat of injustice and see them cast down, ooh, and maybe even becoming part of his legion as he prepares for his own insurrection, I would just really like to see the devil be the ultimate author of mayhem on this one.
That is great, Dave.
That's a great idea for a completely different book.
Well, that's what a what-if is.
That is a great what-if, and I will happily give you credit for that one if I actually am able to write it. But the thing is, you got to remember also, the devil, while, you know, is a relatively young construct, you've got Anubis, you've got Set, you've got Hades, you've got, I mean, these are all lords of the underworld, lords of the dead, what have you. You know, evil, evil bastards.
You're saying they predate the devil?
I'm not saying predate, I'm saying, I mean, in a lineup, who's the more evil? I mean...
Gotta be the devil.
Well, I mean, remember what Set did to, where's my...
Osiris.
Thank you. Cut his ass up and...
Well, We don't have to get into a theological debate about who's the evilest of the dark gods.
So yeah, but you understand what I'm saying. I mean, you can't real in my opinion, and this again is my opinion.
Okay.
Saying that one devil is worse than another doesn't really work for it. Doesn't really work in this mythos, I guess you want to call it, or whatever.
Let me put this out just as a final wrap up of this point, and then I'll turn the mic over to Mike.
Yep.
Turn the mic over to Mike. That's never happened before. when you start bringing in Judeo-Christian mythology, when you start bringing in God and angels and the devil, I would just put out there as something to consider that for most of your audience, for most of your readership, that mythology is the mythology, and the good that is in that mythology is the penultimate good, and the bad, the evil in that mythology is the penultimate evil.
Right.
And I understand what you're saying, that there's, you know, we don't want to get into a pissing match over who's the baddest god, but instinctively in our collective consciousness, there is no one badder than the devil. You can make a point about the different qualifications of badassdom in the evil gods.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that you're dealing with collective consciousness. You're dealing with a subconscious instinct that has been borne out time and again in literature and film and other media. So I just want to put that out there as be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I will now pass the mic off. Mike, did you have other questions or observations for Master John?
Yeah, I had one, and I think it's the most important one. We've been talking a lot about plot here. So let me ask you this. The protagonist of your story is Tom Stanton, right?
Tom Stafford, yeah.
Stafford, sorry, apologies.
No, it's okay. I've called him worse.
Okay. what is his dog in the fight? What is his motivation? What is his goal in this story? What does he get out of being the keeper and protecting the devil? What personal thing does he face? What challenge? And how does he change? And where is he as a person different at the end of the story?
Excellent question.
Oh, yes. Crap. Can I answer that in three parts?
Okay, you can have a paragraph.
Okay,
it's funny because we've been talking about all this other stuff about plot, but that's the most important question, I think.
Right.
Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What does he get? Of course, what he gets, the reason he does what he does, one, he was chosen. Not blind luck, he was chosen. He does it because he's got, one, a stubborn streak a mile wide. Two, he's one of those honor-bound guys that you just hate to have as a wingman. Because he will keep you out of trouble whether you like it or not. So he's dedicated. He won't stop until the job's done. What does he get out of protecting the devil? Well, obviously, he doesn't have to worry about the world ending. Also, he likes to keep... He is a firm believer in justice. You know, if you're accused of something and you didn't do it, you should be defended. So, you know, he gets a burr up his ass about that.
Mike, what do you think about that?
I don't think it's enough. What happened to him? What made him that way? I mean, he wasn't just born believing in justice. What went on in his life that made him committed to that?
And that is something I need to work on.
Okay. And that would be a cool thing to work into the storyline, especially if Tom and the devil have history in some way, shape, or form.
Actually, Tom and actually no, not Tom. Larry and the devil have history.
Yeah, but Larry's a secondary character.
He is a secondary character. But
something to tie Tom, you know, what Mike was saying about having a vested interest. I mean, what you're describing is kind of a passive, you know, and Brian's raised this with other storylines. Mm-hmm. You have a very passive protagonist to whom things happen. And because these things happen, he's sort of pushed in the direction of, well, I'll solve this crime because it's my job as the keeper. But there's nothing in there that's lit a fire under his ass that says, holy crap, you know, and Armageddon, yeah, okay, but everybody's doesn't want Armageddon. That motivation is not distinctive from anybody else in the world. And if anybody else was given the, hey, defend the devil or the world's going to end, yeah, we're all going to say, well, I'm going to give him my best shot. What is it that personally grabs Tom Stafford by the short and curlies and says, oh, hell no. I'm in this game in some way, shape, or form. You know, whether he knew the priest that died, whether, you know, maybe he knows the guy that wants to be the father of the Messiah, and the devil knows this.
Can I give you some examples here, John? And they're really easy. E.C. Myers has a great book just came out called Fair Coin. It's a YA novel from Pyre, which might be interesting. And the basic premise of it is, I won't spoil it for people, is that it's actually a quantum physics story, but you think it's a fantasy story when you first start reading. He has a coin. Awesome. When he flips the coin, he can make wishes, and those wishes come true, but they have repercussions. And as the book goes on, he discovers what those repercussions are, and wackiness ensues. But the story opens up with him being this teenager growing up with an alcoholic mother who can't hold a job down, and he's having to take care of her, and they're running out of money, and his future is uncertain because his mother can't get her shit together. And that seems like a really simple, mundane, not very creative thing. But the fact is, it totally drives this kid's decision to use the coin, and it explains why he uses the coin the way he does and how he uses the coin. So he's not just someone who found a magic coin and makes wishes with it, because the reality of it is, if any of us found the magic coin, we would make wishes with it. It explains why he makes the wishes he makes. And that makes that character so much more compelling, because he's got baggage. We've all got baggage. And I'll give you an example from my own work. Oscar Britton, the main character in Control Point, is a black guy growing up in Vermont with a horrible relationship with his parents. So, right. He's unmoored from his own home because he doesn't get along with his parents, and I have reasoning for that in place. But the other fact is, he's a black guy in Vermont, so he's a person, he's completely out of place everywhere he goes, and so he's casting about for some place to feel like a home to him, and that home is the United States Army. And that way, I hope the reader, the reason I did that, was, you know, a lot of people have asked me, why'd you make Oscar Britton a black guy in Vermont? And that's the answer, is that when he loses the army, as he does throughout the book, it's more poignant because the reader hopefully knows what it means to him.
He's lost the only thing that matters to him. I wouldn't say it's the only thing. It's important, right.
So this is the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And John, we're kind of, I mean, and you got, I got to hand it to you, man. You got some serious guts putting your soul on a chopping block like this and letting us take pot shots at me. Absolutely, my hat's off to you. And one thing I want to say here is these things that we're pointing out, again, I don't think any of them are heavy lift items to fix.
No.
I think that, you know, providing your protagonist with that kind of a motivation. I mean, look at what I said there with E.C. Myers' main character and his motivation for how he uses the coin. That's a really small detail, right? I mean, it's not a big deal. He's a drunk mother. She doesn't have her crap together. And so, you know, the kinds of wishes he makes revolve around that. I don't think you'll have to dig real deep to come up with reasons why Tom behaves the way he does in terms of being dedicated to truth, justice, and the American way or whatever. But I do think that the digging is warranted.
I've been writing everything you guys have been saying down. So, so I will be happy to put you all in the dedication next time.
Fabulous.
John, thanks guys for making my book not suck. Yes, this is book two.
Okay, so you may even have some stuff in book one that you can carry over for that motivation that can then tie in. And then that would be a nice sort of flow in from one book to the next. But
yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm looking for. There are certain things that happen in the, you know, again, I'm not gonna.
You're being a tease. Yes,
I've got to be a.
Let me ask you this, John. You haven't bought me dinner yet.
So
let me ask you this: was there anything that you were hoping to get out of this dialogue that we didn't touch on, or any specific questions you wanted to ask Mike that haven't been raised yet?
Actually, you guys have been... I mean, I've pretty much kept everything open in my head as far as what you guys have been talking about. Okay. And what you guys... What you three have been saying to me regarding this. Mike, I see where you're saying. It's definitely not heavy lifting. It's pretty much, like I said, I'm not even showing. I actually have an editor. I'm not showing it to her for at least probably about another three or four months.
Let's take this home a little bit then. Mike, do you have any final words or suggestions or words of wisdom to impart to Good Master Walker?
I just want to say, John, that the real hallmark of a professional in writing is being able to detach yourself from your work, mm-hmm. and being able to engage in exactly this kind of a thing. I'll tell you, man, when I was, I don't even think right now I would have the guts to do this. So I really, my hat's off to you for being so professional and receptive. And I also do think that from just the baseline of creativity that I'm hearing, you have a lot of great stuff going on. And I think if you combine that with your professional attitude, I think there's really a tremendous amount of potential here. And I absolutely hope you'll dig in, and I hope you'll keep going. And I hope that commitment to the craft and taking as long as it takes to make it perfect is something you'll stick to. And I'll look forward to seeing you on the shelf someday.
Brian, what do you got for John?
It sounds to me like you have just tomes of information on this that you're kind of keeping secret from us, which I think is cool, actually. But you also, you have a really interesting quality that I think kind of ties into perseverance in a way, where we're throwing shit at you and you're not letting any of it stick to you. And then, you know, whether you're making it up as you throw it back at us or not, you're really kind of just, you plug along and you keep going. So I have no doubt that when you finish this, it's going to be something pretty phenomenal and definitely worth the read. So I'm excited to see what you do with it.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks. Absolutely. I'm all blushing over here now.
Well, and I will totally echo what both Mike and Brian have said. Thank you definitely for stepping up. I know it's never easy to put your stuff out there, especially a work that you've already invested a great deal of heart and soul into. And that work shows. The structure that you've laid down is intriguing. The characters have huge potential. And the storyline is, obviously, we couldn't talk, I always say this, but we can't talk this long if the story doesn't have some chops to bear out that kind of discussion.
Definitely. So.
No, I appreciate it. And I just want to thank you all, you three, Mike, Dave, Brian, thank you very much for having me on. I mean, this is my first time on a podcast, so thanks for being gentle.
Dude, nicely done.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was a good time.
Yep.
Yeah, great story too.
So we always exact a vow from our guest writers that when the book achieves the glory it is destined, the high accolades, the laurels are tossed at your feet and you're up there accepting your Hugo or your Nebula or whatever, will you come back to us and let us know so we can put you on our success stories link that does not yet exist, but someday will? Do you solemnly swear?
I solemnly swear and affirm. How about that?
Okay. Awesome. Very cool.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. Mike, Cole, thank you so much for taking time. Yes. I know you got a lot going on, and I appreciate you taking the time and playing in our sandbox, man. This was great fun.
Oh, man, thanks for having me. This is a real blast.
Absolutely. And while this show is going to drop after Balticon, we're recording beforehand, and I got to say, I'm looking forward to shaking your hand there, my friend.
Yeah, that'll be great, man. We'll have a beer. It'll be awesome.
Awesome. Very cool. All right, Brian.
Yep.
Yet another round of literary gold digging.
Absolutely.
Under our belts. And friends, thank you always for tuning in. Whenever you're tuning in, we're grateful that you hit that play button and let us dance in your ears for a while. And hopefully we've unlocked a few possibilities and awakened some and inspired some ideas that'll take you into new directions. If you had a good time, please consider making your way out to iTunes. Rate us. Better yet, exercise those writerly skills and draft us a review. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. If you have ideas for John's story, come out to the website, www.roundtablepodcast.com. Leave a comment. Toss your hat in the ring. And we'll make sure John's aware that those comments come up. And, you know, we have a lot of amazing guest hosts coming up, Brian.
Oh, yeah.
We've got Tim Pratt coming up.
Yeah, pretty.
We got Rachel Swirsky coming up. We got Christoph Laputka.
Ooh.
We've got some amazing people coming up. And friends, if you've got a story you'd love to workshop with one of these amazing people, go out to the Roundtable Podcast, hit that link, be a guest at the top of the page, and put in your submission. We would love to have you on the show, man.
Yeah.
Friends, stay tuned. In a few days, we'll have another guest author, another showcase, and another story to workshop. Until then, Brian, any suggestions?
Go right.
Indeed. All right, friends. Thank you so much. You guys take care. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.